You are listening to They Came From the North, your... We can't even pretend to keep a regular schedule, so I'm not going to say weekly or monthly or bi-weekly or bi-monthly or...
Occasional. We're the occasional.
Your occasional sarcastic dose of irreverent Canadian movie commentary, wit, sardonic behavior, overt racism, you know, all the things that go along with Canada.
That's horrible.
That is horrible.
This is a terrible intro.
Gabe's not even here.
Gabe is not even here. Well, yeah, we're down a Canadian tonight. With me are Andrew Iceman Forbes.
Oh, dear Lord. Why did you do that? Don't make me sword fight you.
John Goose Mercer.
I'm just glad I didn't get Sam down.
And Matthew Maverick Avrek from the Sunshine State of New Jersey.
Email me if you want a pizza roll.
I'm your host this week, Steve Merlin Power, because that's the closest I could get to a wizard. It's lame. What can I say? You know,
because of the restraining order?
Why you'd pick Merlin when Tom Skerritt is right there?
I thought he was Merlin.
Tom Skerritt was Viper.
Oh, well, I'm Viper. Screw that then. It's been a long time since I've seen Top Gun, man.
Merlin was a background character. I think he was Tim Robbins, but he was a background character.
Yeah. Well, I'm Viper then. You can call me Viper. That's cooler anyway.
I have a question.
Sure.
Yes?
It's the thing you miss most about having more hair that you can't ask the barber to buzz the tower.
Negative, Ghost Rider. The pattern is full.
It could be that. Anyway, we digress.
Ghost Rider, known. Male pattern is full.
Oh.
Boom, zing.
Oh. That's
blood has been spilled.
Wow. Anyway, to get down to business, we got to take things deadly serious now because this is a very serious episode of They Came to the North. They Came From the North. Or in Matt's case, he came to the North, but I digress again.
We met in the middle.
We met on the border.
Let's hope not.
We exchanged cheap tobacco and bootleg liquor. And now we're dodging the customs peeps.
Until Kevin Costner busted it up.
Yeah. Oh, damn you, Costner. We didn't even work for Capone, man.
I have a question.
Sure.
What am I talking about?
Exactly. unfortunately, as we did mention earlier, Gabriel Girard, our Francois partner in crime, could not join us this evening. He's off on sabbatical in Vienna or Hungary or somewhere.
I think he's asleep, actually.
He's Skyping with Melissa.
Oh. You guys got to ruin everything. Trying to make it mysterious, enigmatic. And you ruined it. Anyway, it's probably a good thing he's not with us, because tonight our topic of discussion is a little more mainstream than we're used to from Gabe, I guess is the word. And he'd probably be looking down his nose at the rest of us. So, you know, whatever. Anyway.
Looking down past his T-shade optics.
His rimless specs. From his monocle. But no, I can't make... Gabe's too nice. I don't want to make fun of Gabe anymore. Anyway.
Because he's probably going to listen to this.
Oh, he definitely will. We're sorry, Gabe. We still love you.
Fuck off, Gabe.
It's better that he's not here, because the claws are going to come out on this one.
Okay. With that preamble out of the way, tonight our topic of discussion is what some may consider Hollywood royalty in this day and age, what others may consider a cinematic pariah. At any rate, he came from very small, humble beginnings. He got very, very lucky and met some pretty influential friends, and then basically fought against the studio system to realize a dream and built an empire for himself in the meantime. We're talking about not only the father of the Force, but also probably the father of the summer blockbuster as we know it today, Mr. George Lucas.
Woo?
You were not put upon this world to get it. George started small. He grew up in a small town in California called Modesto, which was a little dust ball in the middle of nowhere about, I believe, 2 hours, 2.5 hours outside of San Francisco.
And you just totally missed the opportunity to say a long time ago in a Modesto far, far away.
I did. And I was originally going to use a long time ago joke, but I decided I wouldn't. I'd play the high card. Thanks, John. Stay classy.
Oh my God, are low cards.
you've been playing the high card for this intro?
No, not really.
I hadn't noticed.
Mr. Lucas did grow up in a small town that was not super duper remote, but I guess in that region, it might as well have been, you know, 2 weeks drive away. But he watched fast cars and trucks come and go, picked up little bits and pieces of the beatnik and hippie lifestyles. Before in high school, he became obsessed with racing and hot rods, you know, Ratfink mobiles and all of that stuff. Became quite a gearhead, wasn't much of a student, but did eventually get involved in a crash during a race that very nearly cost him his life. And he vowed to his old man that he would never race again. So he discovered the joy of film. When he was old enough, he relocated to California to, you know, sunnier, more pleasant pastures in Southern California, enrolled in USC, was handpicked by another director, Francis Ford Coppola, to work as an understudy on the relatively terrible musical Finian's Rainbow. But it was an in. He made a critically acclaimed student film called THX 1138B, which went on to become his first theatrical film before he moved on again to American Graffiti, which was, you know, pretty popular for its time. And then, of course, Star Wars, the film that really, you know, changed movie making and how it's realized in the realm of science fiction and special effects for everything that came after it. We're going to go with a little bit of a different format. We're not going to jump in with good, bads, and uglies like we usually do. Lucas has a relatively small body of work. He's only got 6 films that he's really credited as a director of. There's a lot of other stuff that you could dispute. Movies like Radioland Murders, Red Tails, which came out in 2012, I believe. A few other ones that were like produced, quote unquote, by Lucas in the 80s that he actually kind of had more of a hands-on role and really kind of guided what could be considered a hired gun, even, you know, as high profile as Return of the Jedi, where he's not credited as director, but they say he's responsible for about 90% of it. So we're going to leave that. Anything that doesn't have a directed by George Lucas credit is going to be ignored.
No Howard the Duck?
No Howard the Duck, unfortunately. We're going to start right in. We're going to each chime in with our thoughts on his films in chronological order. I'm going to start with Mr. Andrew Forbes, and I'm going to ask him, hey, Andrew, what did you think of THX 1138?
I like it a lot. It's probably my second favorite of his movies that he's directed after the original Star Wars. And even saying that, they're probably pretty close. Now, a caveat to that is that I've only seen the upgraded, somewhat CGI'd version. I've never had a chance to see the original theatrical cut. And one of the things that impressed me was there was a lot of stuff in it that I kind of had to assume was added later because it looked so good. But seemed very seamless. Unlike a lot of the stuff in some of the original Star Wars movies when he started adding things to those. It's not particularly original as sci-fi movies go. It's kind of one of those, oh, we're living in a dystopian time when personal identity is kind of erased and there are robots and totalitarianism and Orwell. Oh my God. But having said that, it's certainly compared to the rest of his movies, it's very experimental feeling, but in a way that still kind of has something of a plot. The fact that Robert Duvall is in the lead role and there are supporting players like Donald Pleasance means that you actually get some really good performances and you identify with the characters, or at least I did, quite a bit. It's also more, there are elements of it that are certain that seem more adult and more mature than his later movies, which seem more juvenile. So I find it's one of those movies. It almost feels like it's something he would have made after. In a weird way, I feel like if you watched his films in reverse order, you would be watching a filmmaker maturing. It really feels that way, unlike any other filmmaker I've ever looked at. I think it's very cool. It's got a very distinctive look. I saw Terminator 2 way before I saw THX 1138. And there's the image of the sort of metal-faced cops. It's not exactly the same as the T-1000 design, but sort of reminiscent of that kind of, very emotionless sort of authority-type figure. And, yeah, cool. Car chase at the end. Woo!
To go backward a little bit, just to give a little bit of background on THX 1138 for people who may or may not be familiar with it, it is, of course, like Andrew says, a dystopian sci-fi. It's very, very much like it's very much done in that classic narrative style of science fiction, you know, Fahrenheit 451, 1984, Brave New World, that kind of stuff. It really is, you know, very, very much a traditional science fiction film in the literary sense. And what I love so much about it is how he handles tone. It's not a warm movie. It's not all happy and warm and cuddly, and it does feel cold, but unlike so many other movies where, you know, you get this cold feeling that also feels really distant and unemotional, it's actually a really intense emotional movie.
Very
you
much
know,
so.
Like, it's not distant at it's, all. It's cold a, it's and not, sterile, but it's not distant.
It's not Kubrick.
No. It definitely isn't like an observational thing. It is very much an in-the-moment kind of movie.
And it's very much about a relationship between these two people in presumably a world where sort of, I don't know if it's the actual sort of sexuality and interpersonal relationships are sort of discouraged, but it's been a while since I've seen it.
Although they're non-existent. And like what's kind of terrifying about it is when you think about, and I remember reading an article on, it was one of the bigger, like the movie sites, you know, like it was a while ago, but it was an article about THX back when the special edition was released, and it was like Leonard Maltin or someone like this wrote it and like talked about how, yes, when you look at the movie at face value, it's got all these influences from classic science fiction. But when you think about the world that Lucas actually created there, and you think that, like, you know, somewhere in this world are baby farms. You know, somewhere in this world, people are just churning out youngsters. And somewhere in this, like, and it's also emotionally cold and devoid of real life that the movie is kind of, when you start to think about this world that he created, it's objectively terrifying. You know, it's a scary, scary thought. And I mean, the movie does a really cool job, and it's something that Lucas does really well anyway, in its world-building facets, you know, like the idea that there's...
Especially given that he didn't have the resources to... I mean, a lot of the locations are sort of on location in sort of what were then kind of architecturally very forward-looking kind of spaces.
Yeah, yeah.
That he was able to use, unlike in things like Star Wars, where he would literally build.
Yeah, yeah.
Build, you know?
And it was entirely convincing. I know I'm someone, I've seen the original numerous times. When we got our first, you know, sci-fi channel per se, when Space first launched in Canada, they used to show THX a lot. They used to show it in a double feature with the Andromeda Strain, like pretty much every Friday night. So it's the movie I've seen a lot. I've studied a fair bit. And when the special edition came out, like you were saying how, you know, you couldn't really discern what was added and what wasn't. You just had to kind of assume. And then that's one of the brilliant things about THX 1138 is the special edition is, you know, in many respects, you don't even notice. You're watching it, and it just feels that much more convincing. It's kind of like, you know, the final cut of Blade Runner. It's where Lucas's, you know, digital pen really, really benefited the film. You know, it just it made it that much more immersive without breaking.
There was only I remember there was only one shot where I thought, okay, this is too obviously CG, and it was one very brief shot of a car when there's a car sort of racing out of this city. I think it was kind of like doing a bit of a jump and zooming past the camera.
Okay, yeah.
It was like, okay, yeah, that was added. But beyond that, everything was very seamless.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie, and I keep, like, when we were thinking about doing this in a traditional fashion, like when we were thinking good, bads, and uglies, THX 1138 was very, very nearly my good. But, I mean, I love the movie. I seriously consider it one of the three best debut films of any director working, you know, like, or who has worked. I consider it just a stunning debut. And I kind of, like what you say, I think is very astute, the whole, you know, it's almost like you're watching a filmmaker mature in reverse. I definitely agree with that, like 110%.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat as Andrew, too, as far as having seen it. I only saw it for the first time when it came out on DVD in the 2004 edition, and I saw it for the second time about a month ago. And, I mean, the CG looks really great, actually. Like, especially when you compare it to, like, the Star Wars prequels or the revamps he did to the original trilogy of Star Wars. Like, these effects look great. Like, it really looks amazing.
I think it helps that everything that he was adding to this was sort of architectural detail.
I call it the Empire Strikes Back treatment. It's all backdrops.
It's all backdrops. There's no, you know, having to move an actor out of the way of a laser blast or over the tail of a very poorly rendered blob alien. So in some respects, it was kind of lucky, I guess, that those were the elements that he wanted to change.
How did the Steve, since you saw the original version, how did the car chase and such look before it was all touched up with it, since you had such a low budget?
I mean, again, you know, there's not really a lot of noticeable difference. It's pretty, like, it all flows pretty similarly. It's not a drastic, you know, upheaval. I'm kind of struggling now. It's been a while since I've seen the original, because I own, like, the director's cut is all I have on DVD or Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. But I'm struggling to even think of the scene that Andrew mentioned, to be honest, you know. And I mean, it is something I've seen several times. It's not a movie that I only watched once or twice, you know. It's something I had seen.
It seems to me it's like just before the car goes into the tunnel.
Where the Blade Runner tunnel?
Yeah. And there's a bit more sort of world around it as it's going by.
Yeah, and I think even then, I think it's a situation where originally that shot was there, but I think he added again the background, right? I think it was just he added in background to it, and that's probably why the car looks removed, you know, is because he added the digital backdrop.
I always loved the kind of the numerical jargon that Big Brother and all the robots using. It's like anyone who's ever stood in line at the DMV or the DMR or, you know, had to fill out any sort of government forms, the movie just takes it absolutely to the extreme. You know, don't use the 714, wait for 32, skip the 1114, see index 24941.
It's worth pointing out, tied in with that, the sound design of the movie is unbelievable. Yeah. And there's sort of this constant overlay of kind of dispassionate voiceovers talking, you know, speaking in these various acronyms and combinations of letters and numbers, and
makes you feel that in that world there's no escape from it. Mm-hmm. Right, wherever you go, it's droning on, drilling, like gnawing into the back of your head. And it's an absolutely terrifying dystopia.
People are inventoried.
Yeah. And you know, even like when you open when they open the cupboard and you see him like staring into the little medicine cabinet. What's wrong? This like robotic detachment from everything, you know? It's just such
Wasn't the police are saying when they're
hitting him with the Klingon pain sticks?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah,
repeating something over and over and over again, and it's it might be, are you in pain, or are you all right?
Yeah, are you okay, or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and they're just wailing on him with billy clogs.
it's crazy. Great movie. Really, like as far as science fiction goes, I think it's one of the classics, you know? It's one of those kind of unsung heroes of the genre, you know?
I can't believe, too, like, how long it was before, you know, what was it, 2004, 2005, they did the new version of it?
2004.
I can't believe it was that long, essentially. Especially since, you know,
sweet Jar Jar Binks money.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a noticeably longer cut too. Like, there's a fair chunk added, I believe. And like, again, it's one of those situations where it's a director's cut where the additions are kind of like, you know, it's character bits and stuff that are kind of cut back into it. So there's little bits and pieces that you pick up on, but overall, it's pretty seamless. You know, it's a pretty seamless director's cut.
It serves. I watched a ton of 70s sci-fi, and unfortunately, not all of them were directed by Robert Wise. So it's there's a lot of bad out there.
Oh my God!
Did you say unfortunately?
Now here's what you tell me. I like motion in my motion pictures, John. I like when characters walk.
That's always nice. All right. Are anyone else have any parting thoughts on THX 1138?
No, but who keeps eating Werther's Originals?
It's not me.
Somebody's unwrapping something.
I have a Mr. Freezy.
Yeah.
There you go. That's what's going on. Moving on from American Graffiti, or moving on from THX 1138, sorry, which was actually a box office bomb. It did terrible, terrible business at the box office. No one came to see it. There was a little bit of hype pre-release just based on the fact that it was a successful short film from USC before it was turned into a full length. And
did it lay waste to American Zoetrope?
It very nearly did. It very, very nearly destroyed Francis Ford Coppola's company, which at that point was a young startup. Coppola basically went to Lucas and challenged him and said, you know, like he had two things he was working on. He had the Star Wars, or Journey of the Wills, I believe it was called at that point. And he had American Graffiti. And Coppola basically challenged him and said, George, I dare you to make, you know, a normal movie. I dare you to make something accessible, something mainstream.
I dare you. I beg you.
The end result,
George,
of course,
don't suck this time out.
Made on a minuscule budget of $700,000 and released by Universal, was American Graffiti, which came out in August of 1973. Lucas basically turned it into a night in the life of his high school years. You know, it was 1962, the last day of high school. It was basically Dazed and Confused for the 1960s. Hot rodding, music, you know, crazy Wolfman Jack doing all the DJing. You know, it was just kind of one of those slice of life movies. It's a night in the life movie, and it very much captures the spirit of that time and that location, you know, George's kind of small town upbringing, or his teenage years anyway. And it was quite a pleasant surprise, I think. You know, again, it was a movie that showed George as an assured director, a great storyteller, and it had, you know, a lot of pretty interesting characters.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think? Huh?
American Graffiti, I have to say, I enjoyed it when I watched it.
Yep.
But there's a certain disconnect from it for me. Like the era it's evoking doesn't do much for me. I would love to never ever hear Wolfman Jack ever again in my life. Like, you know, hate me for that if you will, but I'm just not, that scene is not me. So it was a bit of kind of getting over the fact that I didn't really care about a lot of the music or about, you know, hot rodding down the small town's main strip, and also generally hate Ron Howard. But I mean, it was good. I can't argue that it wasn't a good movie. It was like, there were lots of nice character moments and humor, and it was certainly written better than virtually anything else George Lucas has done. And there's much more of a sense of personal investment. I mean, maybe just the fact that it's actually, you know, set on this planet helped with that. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of like not my thing, I guess. But Richie Cunningham, go for it. Yeah.
I'll jump in. I saw it last week for the first time. I'd never seen it before. I think I tried it once when I was like 13 or so, and I was really young to appreciate it, so I just gave up on it. But last week I gave it a shot. And yeah, I'm similar where I can't. I it's a hard time to relate to, really. But given maybe after about 20 minutes, I was totally into this movie. I mean, I really got to like the characters, just the way the characters were juggled, you know, everybody's little story. And, you know, it's built up as one of the great movies, but if you just take it as, like, a straight movie, I thought it was really good. And I kind of, you know, I don't think there were many, really that many nostalgic movies at the time. And I think we might be kind of taken for granted, too. So, like, anybody who saw it for the first time today, you know, you mentioned Dazed and Confused, which, you know, I think did a better. But I think this kind of paved the way for that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worth saying that, you know, nostalgia being a big part of it. I mean, so much of what it's working for is to evoke nostalgia for a particular era that if that nostalgia doesn't connect with you at all,
yeah, that's fair.
Then there's, you know, that, I think that's probably where I maybe don't appreciate it as much as is fair. But yeah, I mean, I probably had a similar reaction in that, you know, for a while I was like, oh, whatever. But, you know, you get into the movie and you actually start to care about what, you know, what these people are going to be doing, you know, after high school as the world sort of opens up for them and they end up going in their separate ways.
Man, the closing narration. I have to speak of the closing narration because it kind of, how often has it been parodied and satired, you know, the whole Toad went missing in action in Vietnam and da-da-da, you know.
Yeah, it was a bit of a downer.
Yeah. Someone who was killed by a drunk, you know.
And remember John Milner? Did you like John? Well, he was killed by a drunk driver.
I never did talk to the old guy as much.
Throw my hands up and shout.
But I love Dazed and Confused. Dazed and Confused, Jesus, American Graffiti. I do love American Graffiti as a movie. You know, I enjoyed a nostalgia trip of it. And I empathize a lot more with Dazed and Confused because for me, like what Linklater did with Dazed and Confused was he kind of captured – like it wasn't necessarily a snapshot of people who lived in that time. It was just more of a snapshot of youth, you know, and not really knowing what the hell to be at with yourself. And – it doesn't hurt that my high school life was exactly as portrayed in Dazed and Confused, only with Ford Tempos and K-cars instead of Chevelles and El Caminos, you know? Mm-hmm. But
and the Seattle grunge scene instead of the 70s.
Well, no, yeah, we had Metallica and Pearl Jam instead of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. But, you know, I empathize more with that movie. But I definitely do really appreciate it. American Graffiti for what it's doing, you know, and I think it does it extremely well. I think it does it as well as Dazed and Confused does, but I just don't emulate with it the same way. But, I mean, I do think that the performances in it, like I think Richard Dreyfuss and, you know, I do dig the little subplot with the blonde and Wolfman Jack. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, it's just something about the movie, you know, it's kind of it's breezy, it's light, it's fluffy, but at the same time, you know, it's got a few good little twists, narratively speaking, and like just the way it handles the characters and stuff. That it's just light and fluffy enough without being too predictable and without being too derivative. You know.
You know what I enjoy about it? I'm always a sucker for this, and you know how much I love the like ghost like presence of the ship in Master and Commander.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the Acheron is the Bob Falfa of Master and Commander. I just love the whole the specter of Harrison Ford that hangs over this movie. You know, some guy named Falfa is going up to the hill.
Yeah.
Right? And just, all you hear about during the entire movie is, you know, he's dude trying to avoid this race with Bob Falfa.
Yeah, and then he goes out like a punk bitch.
Observation. Paul LaMatte somehow aged into a scandal-ridden guidance counselor / sad-looking Neil Young. Unfortunate. His IMDb photo.
Oh. He was in Puppet Master. Wow.
I want to call Child Services.
Wow.
Oh, man, he was in Rock and Rule.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Who was he?
He was Omar the American. Or Omar, sorry.
Wow.
But, no, I've actually got on the inside of my my writing folder, I've got a Bob Falfa quote on it. You're going to be holding on for mercy when I get this sucker rolling.
That was a nice one.
He's such an immense dick. And yeah, despite the fact, you know, it's an absolutely horrible car crash, I can't help but smile when he rolls his car at the end.
Yeah, it's done well, too, though, you know? Like, it's not horribly shot, either.
But then again, like, it's one of those movies that should end, you know, with the DC cab feeling that you want to watch it again. Sorry, Andrew.
I was like, what? I don't remember that feeling.
The guy makes it up there, you know, Falfa loses a race, the other one. It's like, don't leave me. I'm not going to leave Modesto. And then, you know, John was killed by a drunk driver. I was like, oh, man. I don't want to watch this again.
What a downer. Any more parting thoughts before we move on?
Nope.
Everybody's good. American Graffiti. It's neither a good, a bad, or an ugly. It's just there. Is that our general consensus?
I don't know. I think it would be fair to call it a good, even though I don't really like. Like, for me, it would fall more into the bad category, but I recognize what it's doing.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything really wrong with it. Again, like Andrew said, it's just, you know, kind of the same thing as The Big Chill. If you don't have that connection to the early 60s, it's, it's a hard one to get a grasp of. But it's, if for anything, it did prove that Lucas could do the mainstream very, very well.
Yeah, you know, like, I think, you know, Coppola threw the gauntlet down and said, hey, George, make something accessible and mainstream, and Lucas said, challenge accepted, you know?
Does this mean I get to drive a car again? No, George.
So on a budget of $775,000, it went on to make about $200 million between, you know, the jigs and the reels. And one would think that after that, the man would be pretty much set to do whatever he wanted in Hollywood. But no, his next screenplay, Universal turned it down, went on to, you know, release Jaws. And Alan Ladd Jr. over at 20th Century Fox kind of said, I don't understand it. I don't get it, but okay, let's go. Let's roll.
Man, I'm pretty Ladd awesome, Jr., so we're going to do it.
Was that?
Alan Ladd Jr., wasn't he like basically like pretty much behind any filmmaker he thought kind of had?
Oh, well, he just kind of said, you know what, I like you, so let's do it. You know,
if you won over Laddie, he was behind you 115%.
Yeah. Evidence, you know.
To the fact that he lied to his bosses.
Yeah, evidence, George.
I'm really
Lucas
sad that now we have to say 115%. It's like we've devalued 110%.
Well,
at this point.
Inflation.
We're going through
inflation.
I was just going to say. It's like,
yes. So anyway, what came next what was a modest film when it was in production, had a budget of about $11 million, which was grossly over original budget, which I think was budgeted around $7 million. Alan Ladd basically kept the train on the tracks and kept the rest of the studio wolves at bay so George could put the finishing touches, or what he hoped would be finishing touches, on Star Wars. We don't really need to talk about the legacy of Star Wars, do we? Yeah, we.
Now, I've never seen this movie before we were going to do this podcast.
I watched it last week for the first time, and I got to admit, it was a humdinger of a picture.
I mean, Star Wars, we all know the legacy. Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader, C-3PO, R2-D2, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Princess Leia, Han Solo, Chewbacca, household names, every one of them. What?
He gave birth to the 1980s in 1977.
Everyone wearing dressing gowns.
Yeah, he basically, you know, revolutionized the way special effects were created. He was every bit as involved with the production of this film as what, like, James Cameron would be in much later years with things like The Abyss, T2, and Titanic, and Avatar. You know, he was every bit the hands-on director. He was every bit behind, you know, the guys who would eventually go on to form Industrial Light and Magic, or ILM, you know, Douglas Trumbull and all of these guys. I mean, he created legends with this film.
Having said that,
yep,
I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of what's great about Star Wars, and I mean, I think most people who are really interested in movies basically know this, but a lot of the design of the movie, I think, has to do with why it's so successful.
It's
and
my thunder.
Oh, sorry. Thunder returns.
In spite of all of the special effects, you know, trends that were set by this movie and new paradigms that were established, it was the simple narrative, the classic hero's tale, and just the general overall back to basics and used universe look of the film that really cemented it as the landmark film that it really is. There you go. You happy now?
No.
People don't remember, you know, Star Wars for its special effects. People remember it more for the characters, for the story, and yes, for the design, Andrew. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, for me personally, it's my good. I feel very, very confident in saying that it's George Lucas's best picture. The reason I go to Star Wars rather than THX or American Graffiti is because Star Wars was, this was Lucas let off the leash. This was Lucas left to go crazy. And he did very nearly go crazy.
Yep.
It was, you know, it was his Apocalypse Now. It was his Heart of Darkness. You know, it was a movie that very nearly killed him. But he pushed it as far as he could to attempt to realize his own vision. And artistically speaking, you know, the only thing that limited Lucas there was just time and budget. Just what he had to work with in that era. And if not for this movie coming out when it did, I don't think, I mean, it did, like Mercer said, it changed the landscape. You know, it brought us the 80s before the 80s actually happened. And
yeah.
It created, like, it established an entirely new filmmaking paradigm in Hollywood. It was something that, it changed things. And what's really cool about Star Wars is I can sit down now. I watched the theatrical cut just last week, actually. I sat down and watched the original 77 theatrical cut, and like the bonus disc that came with the two-disc DVD sets a few years ago. And like, what amazes me about Star Wars is it's before the Empire. It's before everything had a name, before there was like a concept behind every little character that appears on screen.
Yeah.
It was, you know, they weren't TIE fighters and X-Wings and all of this stuff. It was Rebel fighters, Rebel ships, Imperial fighters, Imperial shuttles. You know, there was no nameology applied to everything. You know, they weren't talking about how many action figures they could concoct with that movie. You know, it was.
If only they could have talked about midichlorians.
I mean, I think that's really one of the really big strengths about Star Wars is that it felt like it was a bigger world. It felt like there was more there, which is, you know, ultimately filled in too much. But I mean, it feels like they're just a small part of a much bigger world.
And I mean, I tend to feel sort of along with that, is that the more he filled it in with later films, the smaller the universe felt.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Felt smaller and smaller and smaller. It's like, oh, we've seen all these places.
Every sequel / prequel kind of destroys just a little bit of that sense of wonder. You know, it just closes the door on just that one little corner of that universe that gives you that sense of wonder. And the characters as well. I mean, you know, like the evolution of Luke Skywalker from that first film to Return of the Jedi. You know, it does get pretty dark. It does take a dark turn. And, you know, the 20-something-year-old college student film snob in me loves that. But, you know, the 7 or 6-year-old kid who has seen it for the first time kind of resents it a little bit, you know?
There's a time when I was young and stupid. I thought Return of the Jedi was the best of the three.
I love Return of the Jedi.
Because it was so dark. and you know, teddy bears with bows and arrows. It was pretty rad. But no, I mean, there's something about Star Wars. It doesn't have the strength of the Lee Brackett, Lawrence Kasdan script on Empire. So it's a little rougher in that department, but there's also a bit more of a gee whiz factor, especially in the character of Luke, who really is kind of, you know, a stand-in for the audience.
He's our eyes into the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even Lucas, too. I mean, he's even a stand-in for Lucas.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's not felt with really any of the other movies, but this is such a throwback. It's still nostalgia for Lucas, too. It's, you know, all the Flash Gordon serials and stuff that he grew up with.
Yep.
And, like, and there's a lot of Kurosawa in this, too. And, actually, this is the movie that, actually, I eventually discovered Kurosawa because I heard A New Hope was based on some samurai movie.
Hidden Fortress.
I eventually checked out Hidden Fortress, yeah. And boom.
Speaking of, right of Luke as Lucas... Oh, there's a parallel. I mean, also just the fact that, yeah, here's this kid in a small town. What does he do on his off time? He races around in speeders.
not
it can't,
too subtle.
It doesn't get much more obvious.
Yeah. Not too subtle.
No.
And even just, I remember...
And who among us has not wanted to go into town to get power converters?
Exactly.
Bullseye.
I always wanted to know what they looked like, and I refused to pick up any of the extended universe garbage to see. That's what I always loved about Star Wars. I hated finding out, you know, that the Clone Wars wasn't what I thought it was in my head.
Mm-hmm. Clone Wars sounded way cooler.
I think when Star Wars existed, I think his ideas even were very, very different.
He likes to pretend that he had it all mapped out.
No, he didn't. No way.
I always love watching the making of stuff. I believe it's on the making of Indiana Jones. And Spielberg's constantly poking fun at it without out and out insulting George. But I was saying, you know, George's like, I got three of them planned out, which, of course, knowing George, no, he didn't.
It's going to be bigger than James Bond.
Yeah. But
it's going to be better than Bond. It's called Indiana Smith.
Nevada Smith.
But I don't know about that, George, but I can't stop looking at this Jim Steranko painting. It just has so many hooks to pull in younger film fans.
Yeah.
You know, and it, again, like Matt was saying, you know, you discover Kurosawa through it, and it's kind of the gateway drug into what makes a person a movie geek or a movie snob.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that, like, all that cool stuff that hooks in, like, you know, you hear Clone Wars, you hear Jedi Knight, you hear, right? And it's just, that stuff sounds so just awesome.
It's kind of like Dune, only comprehensible.
Yeah. And, like, I'm always the first to admit, if you didn't see it when you were younger, the first act kind of drags a little bit. Like, my wife couldn't get through the first half hour of it. And, I'm like, but baby, you're like 5 minutes away from Han Solo, and that's when the swagger hits the screen. That's when she starts to roll. And that's another reason why this would also be my choice for good, is there's not very many film characters out there I like more than Han Solo.
He's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it too.
What does it say about a person that all my heroes are rogues and scoundrels?
I think a lot of what makes Star Wars so cool, and like a lot of what makes it work so well, is just in his sense of style as well. You know, like how he emulated all these older movies. And you see, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but how many times when I was a kid did I grab my old, you know, taped off MTV copy on beta and queue up the Death Star run, you know, and watch the Death Star sequence, watch that whole, you know, lock S foils and attack formation, and then just start rolling, you know. Because that scene was just so well shot, like all the views from inside the cockpits, and it was just such an exciting sequence. And then what kind of struck me as really funny is when I went back and watched it last week, the Death Star sequence is so much more epic in the special edition than it was in the original. Like in the original, it feels like, yeah, we got to destroy this giant secret Imperial weapon, but we're going to send out four ships, and the Empire is only going to have three. You know, like it felt really small in scale. I mean, when I was a kid, that sequence was the coolest thing ever. Mm-hmm. That sequence was
the original score on Kazoo really didn't quite get me as much as the remastered one.
Man, when I was a kid, I always remembered the sword fight between Obi-Wan and Darth being like crazy epic. And when you go back and watch it, it's kind of like. Not?
It's like Alec Guinness is holding him off with his walker.
Like, why is that bodybuilder attacking that old man? Get off the bus! Get off the bus!
Can I just say, I'm really, really glad that it was shot at Shepperton and Elstree with all of these British guys working on it. Because you get... I mean, I think the fact that it was... shot there probably for budgetary reasons and others means you got I doubt you would have had the same cast.
No, definitely.
That you would have had if it was all shot in California. So I mean the fact that you get guys like Peter Cushing and Alec Guinness and
when I was watching Empire of Dreams, I can't remember the stunt coordinator. I loved listening to him.
Was it the Swordsmaster? The guy did all the sword fighting?
Was it Nick Gillard? Nick Gillard?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The one with Mark, I wouldn't let you do this if it was dangerous.
But yeah, it is a classic movie, and I think it deserves. I think it's earned its reputation as a classic. I think it's, you know, as far as science fiction films go, I mean, there was certainly never anything before it that was even remotely as inventive, and it really kind of pushed things into a new era. Like, I mean, it dragged that genre kicking and streaming into the 21st century, you know, and it did it 30 years before the 21st century started, you know, 23 years. But regardless, you know, it's a landmark achievement as far as I'm concerned. It's a great film.
For better or for worse, it created the concept of the tentpole picture.
Yeah, the blockbuster. Yeah. But and what's not fair about that is people hate Star Wars, or people, like, you know, love to diminish Star Wars based on its legacy, not on the film itself.
Yeah.
And that's just that's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, it really did get so big, and, like, I think Star Wars has a pretty insane, in a really bad way, fan base.
Oh, big time, yeah.
And, like, again, with, like, how the world felt like, you know, Star Wars feels like it's a much bigger world than what we're seeing there. And then you get, like, Return of the Jedi, for example, there's a line, many Bothans died to bring you this information. I don't need 17 books about the Bothans. You know?
I was disappointed. When somebody showed me what Bothans look like.
I don't even want to know. Wikipedia.
They all look like Tin Allen. All of them. Even the ladies.
But you just got to take it as, you know, they're just movies. They're good movies. They're very, very good movies, and that's it. Yeah.
I did want to register one quibble, which is that despite all the amazing effects and design and makeup in this movie, the like guy who's hassling Luke in the bar has the worst makeup I've ever seen in a major movie.
I don't like you either.
Yeah, but he covers it up with his glorious line delivery.
You'll be dead. You just watch yourself.
Wait a second.
We're wanted, man.
Is that Nick Nolte?
I love the robot chicken thing with those two guys. When you see him working as an architect or whatever, and
the
dude with the screwed up face comes and says, "Come on, let's go over to Cantina for a few drinks after work." "Oh no, I don't really want to." "No, come on, let's go. And he kind of forces him over and he starts messing with Luke, and Buddy's like, the guy, the alien speaking gibberish or whatever, is like, "Oh, he doesn't mean it, kid. He's only messing with you, blah, 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 blah." It's all this just big, like, misunderstanding. But again,
it's his drawing hand that gets cut off, isn't it?
Yeah.
He can't
provide for his family anymore.
Well, one thing about the Cantina scene, I like how just sort of casually everyone handles the anti-droid racism.
Yeah.
Hey, we don't want any trouble, guys. We're still going to patronize this joint. Go away in the car.
Yet, you know, they'll let a Wookiee in there. He's not good enough to wear a medal. He's the only Rebel character who isn't a general in Return of the Jedi.
Well, to be fair, would you want to stick a pin into Chewbacca's chest?
Clip it onto some hair, that's all.
Velcro.
Yeah, you get a nipple.
Do they have Velcro in the Star Wars universe?
They should. A little long time ago. And yet somehow they still have the metric system.
That's right. But yeah, I mean, Star Wars, there you go. The legacy, I mean, we could probably sit here and devote an entire podcast to discussion just on A New Hope alone. But we won't.
We should talk a little bit about the how he went back and changed the effects.
We should. We definitely should.
That's a weird thing for a director to do, or at least a unique thing for a director to do to his movies.
I wish I could have, you know, the Blu-ray quality that, you know, that beautiful Blu-ray remasters. They're amazing. They're absolutely stunning to watch. I just wish I could have A New Hope without that entry to Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
I really do. I wish I could have it without that little sequence of about 2 minutes where it's just special effects.
Robots! Dinosaurs!
Yeah, you know, exactly.
I'm a
sorry, I don't
toaster.
Know where that came from.
You don't know where what came from?
That really, really bad dinosaur noise.
My
son's watching me and I'm trying to impress him.
So, you know, in 1997, Lucas did go back 20 years after the original, and he did kind of attempt to bring Star Wars closer to his original vision by adding some CG effects. He spruced up the costumes in the canteen.
And, of course, original is in large air quotes.
Large, very, very large air quotes. He also set up, some more connective tissue, I think was the word that was used, between that and the prequels. Inserted Boba Fett and Jabba the Hutt into the first film to kind of bring it closer to the third, even though they had filmed the scene with Jabba as a fat Irishman, who he claims was always just a stand-in, even though
he's in full makeup.
Yeah, and in the old Marvel Comics adaptation, that sequence was actually in it. And it was that old character, you know, the guy in the black vest, you know? But it...
He was like Mud from the original Star Trek series.
It was controversial. I mean, you know, I went to see it in theater, and I thought it was just great to be seeing it on a big screen, and I walked out pretty excited. It was 1997. I was probably stoned when I watched it, I won't lie. But, you know,
Rebel Steve.
Steve, we have young listeners.
I'm counterculture, man. What can I say? I go to the movie theaters high and watch Star Wars.
Yeah, I have an admission to make. Yeah. The first time I saw a Star Wars movie was in its entirety was 1997.
Yeah.
Now, I was born in 1982, so that means I was 15 before I saw Star Wars.
Okay.
How does that happen?
Deprived.
Because my parents would not rent Star Wars for me. And what I used to get out from the library, because I was allowed to borrow things from the library in the kids section, so I would get the making of Return of the Jedi, and I borrowed that video so many times. I'd never seen the movies, but I knew exactly how they made the third one.
I mean, we all have a first Star Wars experience, I'm sure.
Sunday afternoon, NTV.
There you go. How about you, Matt?
I remember I was really young. I saw the Droids cartoon first.
Okay.
And then for some reason I saw The Empire Strikes Back first when I was like 5.
Oh, and I saw the Ewoks cartoon.
Yeah, it was one of those too, yeah. But when I saw R2 and 3PO walk on screen, I was expecting Popeye to walk on screen next, and like Looney Tunes. I'm like, oh, my cartoon characters are coming in this movie. Not realizing it was from Star Wars.
The Empire did not want any of Popeye.
My first was Return of the Jedi. I saw it in theater the night before opening night. It was 1983. I was in grade 1, I think. And
45 years of age.
Yeah, there we go.
Grade 1.
But no, the sitter I used to go to after school during the week, one of her daughters had won tickets on one of the local radio stations to see an advanced screening. And she took me. She figured, hey, he's into Transformers. He'd love this movie. You know, so she took me to see it. I had never experienced anything Star Wars before. I still have the original program book from at home somewhere at my mother's house. And I had gone to see it the night. I actually fell asleep after the Tatooine sequence and woke up again sometime just before the Endor hell broke out. But I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life at that point. The next day in school, I wasn't in school because I was out late, and you know the teacher had told the whole class that Steve wasn't going to be in class today because he had gone to see the new Star Wars movie the night before. So Friday, I show up in school, and everybody is like hammering me with questions about it, and I'm just kind of like, I don't even know what any of you people are talking about because this was the only one I've seen.
You know, well, I was going to say, like, on one hand, I was about to say, like, did any of it make sense? Because you're coming in the third movie. But at the same time, it's like kids that age, they don't know what any movie's about.
No, oh God, no. I just thought green laser sword, awesome. But, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I loved it. From then on, that weekend, I believe, we watched the first two. We watched Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back because, of course, ANTV showed them because Return of the Jedi had just opened. So, I mean, that weekend I sat down and watched the other two back-to-back, and that was actually when I made my initial recordings of them on beta, and those tapes got wore out within a year. You know, so, I mean, I was very passionate about it. I did really, really enjoy, you know, my Star Wars as a kid. But I did kind of grow out of it when I hit my teenage years. I discovered Indiana Jones, and I really, that became my thing, was Indiana Jones more so than Star Wars, and I just kind of moved away from Star Wars. But, you know, that's it. That's so it goes.
You don't like Indiana Jones.
Not at all. Hate those movies. Terrible. Anyway, yeah, Lucas finished up Star Wars, went on to, you know, other things.
A great career in merchandising.
Great, yeah. Started up his empire. I think a lot of what happened with Lucas in the 80s was, I think a lot of it was just exhaustion. I think he was so exposed, and he had put himself so out there with Star Wars that
he put the stickers on all of these lunchboxes, and that was a lot of work.
Well, I mean, it's just, I think where he did have the merchandising rights and all of that sort of stuff too. I mean, which was at that point, you know, Fox looked at him as like, merchandising rights, really? Okay, you know, sure. But I think where he handled it all, where it was him behind it, he maintained the rights to it. He maintained, you know, ownership of his property and the action figures and the lunchboxes and the bed sheets and all that. I mean, where it was his team that was behind all that, not some merchandising team at Fox, you know, like
we must never forget the bed sheets.
I think it was burnout. I think it was just exhaustion. And I mean, Empire Strikes Back hit, which he bankrolled himself. And I mean, people still don't really understand how much of a gamble Empire Strikes Back was when he made it. You know, I mean, yes, Star Wars had been immensely popular, and nowadays we'd say a sequel to an insanely popular movie, oh, it's a given. But at this point in time, the tentpole didn't exist. You know, mm-hmm. Jaws and Star Wars were flukes.
It was more like
the Ape sequel.
It was more like
the
yeah.
No, I was going to be even more douchier. You remember the Thin Man?
Yep.
The movie's got thinner as as the sequel came out.
Yeah.
We're not going to spend more money on a sequel. People are going to see it anyway.
But it was a situation where, you know, Empire Strikes Back was a gamble. Lucas bankrolled his entire, you know, like everything he had made on Star Wars went into Empire. And, I mean, thankfully it paid off. Thankfully, you know, it had become this cultural phenomenon. But, I mean, he was so deep in the trenches at the time that he didn't even realize it. And, of course, then came Return of the Jedi. And, of course, by that time his legacy was cemented then. I mean, it was he'd had Indiana Jones. And, well, then came Howard the Duck.
Directed by William Huck.
Really, we know who really directed Howard the Duck. Radioland Murders is in there somewhere. Willow, which I absolutely adore, but we won't speak of. And the Star Wars Special Editions, of course, 1997 and all of that, and remastering the controversial Who Shot First, Han or Greedo. Again, we won't talk about it. I've heard Lucas's justification for it, and I kind of agree with him. I just think it was done in a piss-poor fashion. But it wouldn't be until 1999, after, you know, in a very extended hiatus, that he would return to directing again with, surprise, another Star Wars. This time we go back to the beginning, to the very, very origin of the Skywalker clan, with Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
You know what the best way to begin this one would be?
You know what? I saw it opening night. It was the first public showing in North America. CNN was there. There was some dude dressed up as Darth Vader leading his kid down the aisle of the theater while like 500 nerds shouted out the Imperial March. It was absolutely mind-blowing. And when we sat in that theater, you know, you see all these jaded, cynical idiots online, oh, within 5 minutes the excitement was gone and da-da-da-da-da-da. No, that did not happen. That was a lie. Everybody in that theater was like they were sitting on a hot plate the entire time that movie was on. And the applause when those closing credits hit was deafening.
And now it's like looking in a mirror and saying, what were we thinking?
It was. I think it was just, you know, initial excitement at the fact that Star Wars was back after, you know, such a long period.
I do remember. I will say this. I went and saw it. It certainly wasn't opening night, but it wasn't before. It wasn't sort of after it had been out for a while. It was one of the first few days, and I was super excited about it. And I came out thinking that I'd love the movie, but I definitely do remember being sort of conscious that I was kind of lying to myself about some of the lamer parts.
For the most part, I still enjoy Episode One, and I think, like, I'll say it straight out, if I were picking a bad, it would be Episode One.
Mm-hmm,
I still think it's the strongest of the prequels. I do think on its own, taken on its own merit, it is the strongest of the three prequels. I also think that if you put all six movies together, it is completely useless. It serves no purpose.
Yeah, it's kind of what I wanted to say. Like in and of itself, it's actually really good.
It is.
You know, the way the movie's mostly made, it's good. But I actually want to compare it to Temple of Doom, where it's like it's a really, really, really good movie with a few really bad things that are about it, pretty much. Like the end battle.
Don't go dissing Temple of Doom.
Yeah. I was going to say, the flaw in your logic right there is Temple of Doom is amazing. And
compare Willie Scott to Jar Jar Binks.
No. No.
You kind of got that a little bit.
But, Darth Maul's no mole around.
I'll give you that. But it's like, it's got some, you know, the final battle, it's four simultaneous large-scale battles going on all at the same time, and it's really well done, but, you know, two of them are won by bad comedy.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, Looney Tunes, Jar Jar Binks, and you've got the kid accidentally blowing up the planet by randomly pressing buttons. Yeah. I mean, the space station on the planet. And, you know, it's, you know, the lightsaber battles are amazing. It's got the best sword fights and choreography in the entire all six movies.
I don't remember where it was I read, but I know it's out there. It's floating around the void that the lightsaber battle between Maul and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn was actually filmed by Steven Spielberg.
Hmm. I'm going to go ahead and disagree with any of you saying that this movie's remotely good. Now, first of all, I mean, I'm going to completely overlook the fact that it serves no purpose narratively in the whole series because, you know, whatever.
It does. It serves no purpose.
But on its own merits, we have two characters that were expected to be somehow interested in right from the beginning, despite them having virtually no personalities whatsoever.
Yep.
All of the amazing choreography, yes, in terms of just athleticism, it's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. But every single battle in the movie, it's almost kind of a problem I have with some Pixar movies, where every movement is so considered that, like, I just get the, like, it's entirely manufactured, and I have absolutely no sense of danger in any of these sequences.
There's not a movement wasted.
There isn't, yeah. And that's a problem. You know, it's an achievement, but it's a big problem for a movie where you're expected to care about what happens.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure, that three-way lightsaber battle looks fantastic, but it doesn't have anywhere near the emotion in it that the Vader-Luke battle in Return of the Jedi.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah, I'm not going to say that the Vader-Obi-Wan battle from the first movie is better than these, because it's clearly not. But I find the whole thing, the precision and the sort of staggering amount of detail where every human participant in it just feels like a cog in a giant Rube Goldberg machine.
Fair enough.
That's what every one of these sequences feels like. And so I don't connect with it at all. The other main character is a kid who is so ill-considered. Everything about him, the way we meet him and his relationship with his mother and every character who surrounds him on this stupid planet that I hate, the fact that it's all about, like, trade blockades and taxation and things like that in this completely dense, impenetrable wall of exposition all the time that you're supposed to care about at all.
It feels more like Star Wars fan fiction.
It really does, yeah. And, I mean, you can tell that Neeson doesn't care at all. I mean, he's... You can tell. I mean, Ewan McGregor, he's quite good at being a younger Alec Guinness.
Yeah.
But his character has nothing to do throughout the thing.
No.
The whole Amidala / her body double thing is ridiculous, and the way she's talking throughout the whole movie is terrible. Jar Jar Binks, I'll just say Jar Jar Binks, and all of his people. This is one case where I would happily endorse genocide. It's just terrible.
Fair enough. Matt, you got anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, like, as far as like,
we can't argue with those points at all.
It just, yeah, I mean, it felt like it was going in a certain direction, and then the other two episodes, two and three, just kind of went in its own way, and like has nothing to do with the rest of the series. There's characters who are like unique to this movie, and just, you know, it's, you know, as good as, yeah, you know, I stand by the good things I said about it, but it's, you know, it just falls apart, completely falls apart, and it goes nowhere, and it's its own little separate little movie that you don't need to watch when you watch the rest of the movies.
I'll say this, the pod race is still mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why people went to this movie in many ways, is because that was used as promotional material.
Yeah.
And that was a mind-blowing bit of effects work and action filmmaking, and it still holds up.
And that first trailer was amazing. The first trailer for that film, like what starts with the Gungans coming out of the mist and stuff, that trailer was phenomenal.
Did anybody go to see Wing Commander in the theaters just to see that trailer like I did?
Yeah. And you know what?
I went to see Wing Commander in theaters for other reasons, but...
I actually really enjoyed Wing Commander.
Because it was the other major Mark Hamill... franchise.
Oh, yeah. He's in the game, yeah.
We're seeing it. Breaking Kevin's heart one night. It's like, you know, Kev, for somebody as acclaimed as David Suchet, he's been in a lot of terrible, terrible things.
My parting thoughts on episode one, like I said, it's my bad, and it's my bad for many of the reasons that Andrew stated. You know, like, there's so much there that doesn't work. But at the same time, you know, I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it. I liked how the action unfolded. I enjoyed the lightsaber fights at the end of it. I had a lot of fun with this movie. It was great to go back to that
film again.
And
I'm glad it exists only for what it's given to Spaced. for Tim's character and for the callbacks with Peter Serafinowicz.
I liked it because of, you know, I wasn't one of these obsessive Star Wars fans. I wasn't one of these people who pored over every piece of fan fiction or every piece of expanded universe or every novel or whatever, you know. Like, yes, I was a Star Wars fan, but I was a fan of the old Star Wars movies, and that was pretty much where my love ended. And it was nice to go back to that place again after so long. You know, it was nice to see something fresh and something new. And no, it didn't live up to the originals, but at the same time, I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it, and to me, it still felt like a Star Wars film. You know, like, those movies were never movies for adults. They were never movies to be deeply pondered.
Because I remember this is something Lucas said at the time, was that, you know, reviews coming out of this were terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, you know, it's okay. You know, the Star Wars movies have always gotten bad reviews. They're movies for kids. There is a marked difference between the two series. The approach to them is entirely different.
It is.
The approach to the prequels is that of someone who already has an established empire, who has nothing but yes men all around him, who wants to put as much detail into every scene as possible, whether or not that has a positive impact on the scene, whether or not it's necessary at all.
I think it has more to do with a man who's kind of, you know, in terms of storytelling, has regressed. I think it's simple. I think, you know, the prequel trilogy is Lucas's way of breaking all the old toys out of the closet and just having an old fashioned spaceship battle in the sandbox. You know, it's him regressing to telling the stories that he wanted to tell as a child. You know, whereas when A New Hope was,
he didn't have the pressures that he had in the previous movies.
When A New Hope was made, he was hungry young filmmaker George Lucas. He was trying to create a serious science fiction film, you know, whereas with Episode One, he was just going back to that place that originally inspired what he created with the old series, with the old movies.
At the same time, though, by the time Phantom Menace was made, he'd been getting told that he was like the greatest filmmaker of all time for 20 years.
Yeah.
So he doesn't challenge himself so much.
No, exactly.
And I think that came out in the filmmaking too. Like, a lot of the reason all the characters are wooden is because, you know, like, oh my God, we're making Star Wars. Like, this, it's a big deal. Yeah. Whereas, like, when the first movie came out, they thought they were making some crappy movie that was going to be forgotten. So they were just kind of having fun with it. Like, that.
What's going on with George in that science movie?
what's kind of shitty about the whole affair is, thanks to the internet, his original idea was kind of shit-canned. The story, or so it goes anyway, the popular story is that originally he had cast Leonardo DiCaprio to play Anakin in all three. But because of the fan reaction, when the news leaked out, when sites like Dark Horizons and all these guys picked it up, because the backlash was so vehemently strong, he kiboshed it and went back to the idea of having Anakin as
Oh, thank God we've got Jake Lloyd.
But
I
think that was
a bullet there.
I think that was one of the foibles of the prequel trilogy, was the fact that you had the two different Anakins, you had the two different age groups. I think if Anakin had been played by the same actor in all three movies, it would have fit together a lot better and it would have made a lot more sense.
Still would have been terribly written.
Oh, well, I mean, that's neither here nor there. It's neither here nor there, but...
Yeah, I don't want to end this on a down note, but I just got to bring up the fact, and it might be where... God, how old was I when that came? When was that movie released?
99.
No, I mean, what month was it? It was beginning of the summer? Oh. It was Memorial Day, wasn't
May.
It?
May.
Yeah, okay, so I would have still been 16 at that point.
It was 2 weeks after The Matrix and a week after The Mummy. Or Voice.
The Phantom Menace was the first time, and when I saw it, the theater was crazy. And we were all jumping and howling and cheering and everything. And I came out of it like, this was the greatest movie I've ever seen. The next morning, once the sugar had subsided, that was the first time in my life I ever felt movie disappointment. That, you know, you didn't have that, I gotta see it again, I gotta see it again, I gotta see it again, or I can't wait to have this one on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was the opposite. I did want to see it again right away, and I did see it again. I saw it twice in theater, and
this is why you must.
All
be
I wanted, to, yeah. But see, when I went, if I went to go back to see it, all I wanted to see again was the pod race and the lightsaber fight.
Fair enough. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it. Like I said, it's not a movie I regret watching, and I also don't regret my enjoyment of it. However, I do feel that it doesn't fit with the rest of them. Which leads
Steve, you're being pretty complacent now. We got to move on so you can get really angry.
Which leads me to Lucas's next film, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones.
Snicked.
picking up 3 years there. Was it 2 years? 3 years later?
It's always three years.
3 years later, yeah. You know, we had
a great life philosophy. No context. It's always 3 years.
Yeah. It's a situation where... there was definitely some knee-jerk going on. There was definitely some reaction to the fan reaction to Episode 1. Lucas,
Jesus, take the wheel!
Yeah, Lucas definitely kind of backpedaled a lot. He did compromise somewhat based on the vehement disregard of Episode 1. In comes Hayden Christensen as an older, more mature Luke or Anakin Skywalker. A lot more action, a bit of a darker tone, much darker design, considerably less Jar Jar Binks, a little more heavy-handed morality, and some crazy, crazy, crazy CG action sequences. Unfortunately, what was left behind for me personally, and the reason I choose Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, as my ugly, is the heart and soul. There was no soul in this picture whatsoever. None.
It was just like sand.
It was, man, watching that final battle sequences, everybody in theater is going absolutely apeshit. I'm sitting there going, man, I feel like I'm watching an opening cutscene from a video game. There's no, like, none of the characters are involved in the action.
Breakdancing Yoda.
Oh, Powerball Yoda. Hayden Christensen. Oh, Hayden Christensen.
I think that guy gets kind of a bad rap.
Oh, he does. He does. I agree. I think it's just, it's one of the...
Yeah, I'm going to let you guys in on a dark secret.
Yeah.
He was awesome in Takers.
I haven't seen it. Couldn't
he was one of the best... Well, dude, I can't... If a movie even implies a heist, I have to see it.
I didn't mind him in... what was that one where he could teleport everywhere? Jumper. I thought he was pretty cool in that.
I saw him in Shattered Glass. That was pretty good. More of a dramatic thing.
Yeah.
Was that the one about the... the reporter?
Yeah.
That one was really good.
R2-D2.
Again, I think it, when you see him in something else, it kind of shines a light back on Lucas's screenwriting ability.
Yeah.
And directing technique.
I think it's more directing. Yeah. I think it's more.
Yeah, there you go. So.
You know, in the early days, you had, you know, Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, who could butt heads with Lucas, who could say, you know, what was the famous Harrison Ford quote? You can type this shit, George, but we can't say it. But
you had Alec Guinness on set.
Yeah, with the prequels, you have a situation where this is George Lucas, the all-powerful and omnipotent, yeah. And, you know, he's surrounded by a bunch of people who are like, holy crap, I'm in a Star Wars movie, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, how can you make Christopher Lee so boring?
Yeah, seriously, the Christopher Lee as a I don't even want to say Sith Lord because I hate the extended universe stuff.
It's never even really made entirely clear what the hell he is.
No, Christopher Lee, Christopher Lee as a Star Count Dracula as a Star Wars villain. If it hadn't been CG sets, this should have been a situation where they had to rebuild the set after every take because he just devours scenery.
I mean, like,
I don't know, George.
Going on, yes. Like what Dooku is? Why are we rooting against the Separatists? And is the stakes of the battle don't mean anything. They're just we're rooting against them because they're the other side. Like, what's the point of the whole thing?
I remember not knowing what was going on. And not caring.
And that's the thing. And something that was – that's a disappointment of the whole trilogy, the whole prequel trilogy is that, you know, two sides are being played against each other for no reason. Mm-hmm. And it's not – if you know, that could have been something. That could have been something you could have done with these movies.
And especially where he's such a Kurosawa fan.
Yeah.
He totally needed the Sanjuro character in there.
Yeah.
And then you get – you know they're the bad guys because their ships are all sharp and pointy and angular. That's why they're bad guys. You know that. You don't need to know
and
why.
It's Christopher Lee.
Yeah, and Christopher Lee, obviously, he's got white hair. He's a bad guy. He's old. All the old people are bad guys. But
he has an accent.
I think it's a prime example of, like, with Episode 2 in particular, and I mean all the stuff with Jango Fett and all of this stuff. It's like, you know, all Boba Fett was a cool costume. That's all he was. Yeah.
And but that's all he ever should have been.
Exactly. Right? He should have been, you know, like the man with no name in
precisely.
You know, he never should have been fleshed out. And all the fan theories and shit that were floating around in the 80s about how he was a disgraced stormtrooper who found this old Mandalorian army and armor and all of this stuff, like, that shit was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That shit was so cool. And then to just...
No, he was a sad kid.
Yeah. You know, like, this is all stuff we didn't need to see. This is all stuff that never had to be created.
And again, in the Christopher Lee vein, again, how do you pronounce it? Tamora? Morrison?
Tamora.
Again, yeah, as Jango Fett, this should have been another, like, great one of those movie villains that everyone else hates, but John loves. You know, it's Colonel Quaritch all over again.
Right? Can I just say, the weirdest thing about Tamora Morrison being in this movie was that I lived in Fiji for a while in the 90s, and so I would see New Zealand TV, and he was on this New Zealand soap opera.
Yeah, he was huge in New Zealand, wasn't he?
So I just associate him with Shortland Street, this soap opera from New Zealand. And then
you lived in Fiji?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, too many centipedes. But
and too many centipedes really and Samoan Jimmy Snuka's kids kept taking my lunch money.
It's kind of funny because, like, Episode 2 with me, it was an odd situation because, I mean, Episode 1, we had our tickets months before and, you know, all of this excitement and all of that stuff. Episode 2 was kind of I had gotten off work 6 p.m. I'd gone over to the mall. I knew the manager at the theater at the time. It was a guy named Tom, really nice guy. And I had said, you know, I guess how Star Wars is all sold out tonight. He said, actually, there's a few tickets left if you wanted to go. I was like, really? Like, okay. And, you know, 3 years earlier, I would have been like, yes, give them to me, give me, give me, give me, give me. Whereas instead, I went out to a payphone and called Sarah. I was like, Sarah, did you want to see the new Star Wars tonight? She's like, yes, 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 yes. And she was more excited about it than I was. And a really good friend of mine who was a huge Star Wars nut, you know, I called him. He's like, yes, man, I'll be there. You know, so the three of us ended up going. And,
question, were you married then?
No, we were not.
See, that should have been a red flashing light.
Dude, she smiles like Marion Ravenwood. I rest my case.
Yeah, don't you dare ever insult Sarah Powell.
She still has Marion Ravenwood's smile, okay? And she looks good in an indie hat, so. But anyway, you know, it was a situation where I wasn't even really overly excited for it because the trailers I had seen and the stuff I'd been reading about it was kind of like, oh, really? Oh, you know? But, yeah, I ended up seeing it and came out and thought, it was okay. You know, kind of nonplussed. But I didn't really hate it, I guess. It was when we watched it, the night it came out on DVD, when we sat down at the old apartment and watched it. That was the night I hated it. That was...
Oh, that was my swearing-in night.
That was the first night Mercer
that's when I got patched in.
first night you ever met any of us and hung out with us outside of like a work environment. And we're sitting down watching this movie, and about three quarters of the way through the movie, Kevin Woolridge, who's like our actor, stage manager, you know, he's our friend.
Mustachioed god.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and like, you know, our stage brother, who up to this point loves everything. You know, Kev was always really enthusiastic. He's a big nerd. And we're sitting down watching episode two, and he, like three quarters of the way through the movie, he's like, you know what, guys? This is a really shitty movie. And I was like, you know what, Kev? You're right, man. This really is a shitty movie. But yeah, there's nothing about episode two that works for me. Nothing.
Yeah, he's putting too much emphasis on effects. And like, you hear him bragging about the quantity of effect shots thrown in this movie versus the last movie.
Yeah.
This one has 800 effects. Last movie had only 642. And like, when you look at the... I don't know if I'm just saying this...
Purple lightsaber, the creepy... Close Encounters aliens on their rain planet. The prequel trilogy, I hate the way all the aliens talk. Everybody's like a racial stereotype.
Yeah.
I didn't really have that issue. I don't know why.
No, it's just, it's when you listen to it, it's like they're trying, you know.
It's the Chinese
first trilogy
stereotype
had,
alien. Jamaican stereotype. And then the Middle Eastern stereotype.
But I hate.
I'm surprised there wasn't just like this guy who came down. I'm the space Jew.
Watto was pretty much a stereotypical Jewish character.
He was the Shylock.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I watched the first trilogy had the, the way Jabba the Hutt and everyone spoke.
Jibba Jabba.
But I mean, then you had like, what's the rain planet called?
Kamino.
Kamino.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Better answer.
Wachito Dida, Master Jedi. And it's just, you know, and again, this tells you at this point how thoroughly nonplussed I was with Star Wars, is that you know, the camera pans over a room with 10,000 Boba Fetts in it, and I just... Meh.
Couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the Colosseum thing at the end of it just made me flinch.
Ugh, that was terrible.
Powerball, when Yoda goes Dragon Ball Z.
And C-3PO had, like, all of these terrible puns.
I've fallen and I can't...
So we're going...
I'm beside myself.
Yeah.
I'm
glad you could remember them and quote them. I wasn't gonna look.
Just made me wish every time every time he opened his mouth that Chewie just step on screen and tear his arms off.
Is it just me? Rewatching all six of them before the podcast, episode two in particular looks the most like Roger Rabbit. Looks like a cartoon.
Yeah, it looks.
When he's in that diner with that guy at the diner.
Awful.
It looks like a cartoon.
Dexter Jetster.
Dexter.
Again, there's...
I get that you like this, but why would you... Like, okay, maybe bring elements of, like, the 50s diner stuff that you like into the design, but to just put a 50s diner with an alien in a greasy wife beater...
Didn't he have a French fry hat on?
Yeah.
Like, off to the side a little bit?
Yeah.
Like, it's essentially... He's an alien pop tape.
The only bright point of the movie for me, like the only redeemable factor in Attack of the Clones for me, is again Ewan McGregor.
He the one thing I liked about it was his sort of like playing detective kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which was actually kind of cool, but it was just executed terribly.
Yeah.
Well, it's just what he was going after wasn't interesting, and it should have been.
Yeah, and that's the key right there. That is it.
Like, he should have been unraveling this absolutely massive galactic-wide conspiracy, and it's just Lucas knows what a conspiracy is, but he doesn't. Like, he's point in his career, he was nowhere near clever enough to write one.
Like, oh, you're making a whole bunch of clones? Oh, yeah, sure, we'll take those. All right, yeah.
Okay, like, so I kind of feel like he just basically took, like, the tired old... Or, I don't know, maybe he opened up, like, a copy of The Prince and then a copy of the Financial Times and just picked words.
Picked words and sentences. Oh.
Yeah, and I mean, this is from a... this is coming from a guy who's, you know, third movie created that whole... Let's try to jam in references to Joseph Campbell wherever we can.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Let's try to find the heroic journey wherever we can. And it's just... Attack of the Clones is a mess.
And I mean, you want to see epic. You want to see something like where you're really invested and like you got epic stakes on the go and like the conflict just feels so huge. The final chapter of Return of the Jedi. You know that?
Yeah.
But that final act, that three-way struggle at the end of Return of the Jedi is just absolutely phenomenal in how it moves, how it cuts back and forth. Nothing ever feels, you know, crowded out by the others.
It builds on.
Yeah. I to this day, still get goosebumps on my arm when Luke finally pulls the two lightsabers clash in front of the Emperor's face and, you know, it does the fade out.
It's such an amazing sequence. And the way it cuts back and forth is brilliant.
But then, you know, you've got...
Attack of the Clones.
In Attack of the Clones, you've got, you know, the family tradition of the Fets of going out like putzes.
Yeah, and all your central characters, like your three or four main characters are all standing on a ship watching the action unfold. They're not involved in it. You don't have that character investment in the fight sequences like you do in Return of the Jedi. You never feel any sense of peril. You know, like, it's just...
Yeah.
Oh, one thing. Okay, this is kind of taking us back a bit, but I did just want to bring one thing up about kind of the calculated. It sort of ties in with Lucas's latter-day merchandising approach to stuff, but also calculating in order to get nerds excited about what they're going to see, and the whole. This is going back to Phantom Menace. The whole. Darth Vader created C-3PO thing. Is the dumbest thing.
Why did you have to go there?
Ever happened.
Why did you have to go there?
Because I was looking through pictures of Attack of the Clones, and I saw a picture of him half built.
Oh.
And I'm sorry.
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Anyway, any parting thoughts on episode 2 outside of how much it sucks?
I mean, just like that with the character. It just makes the world smaller. Makes it, things that were bigger now are smaller. Now, you know, later built 3PO. The
you don't want to sell me death sticks.
That's probably the one good funny part.
You want to go home and rethink your way, your path in life.
Yeah.
I've read science fiction rabidly since 1986. The night I saw this movie in theater, I was embarrassed to be a geek.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that as some rabid Star Wars nerd, because I'm not a rabid Star Wars nerd, but I don't have suspenders on right now. My teeth are nice. I don't have acne. I'm married.
Immediately, when I think Star Wars nerd, I think bad teeth and suspenders. How did you know?
Dude, I totally think of Poindexter.
I'm sorry, man. Star Wars nerds are way cooler than comic nerds.
But I was just...
Wrong.
Yeah, no, I came out of this movie and I was not mad. It's just... It was the first time, I was embarrassed. I was like, you know, this should have been my.
This
should have been
what
my,
we asked for.
Yeah.
Yeah. This should have so totally been my jam, and it wasn't.
Fair enough.
My childhood was asking for it.
Now it's
your childhood all dressed up like that.
Okay, moving on. We get to Lucas's most recent directorial effort, and probably. One of his last, I'm thinking, if current trends stay, you know.
He's going to make low-budget art films, didn't you hear?
I hope. I sincerely hope that he does. I really do. I hope he pulls a Francis Ford Coppola and late in life discovers, like, Italy or something and, you know.
But you know, better.
Yeah. Better than Tetro, please. Anyway, we get to Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. Which, I will say, in terms of like competent construction and narrative treatment and acting, performances, effects, etc., is the best of the prequel trilogy. I probably have a little more fun with Episode 1, but like as an objective movie viewer and looking at construction and that sort of thing, I'd have to say Episode 3 is definitely the best of the prequels.
But from my point of view, Episode 3 is evil.
Yeah?
You're breaking my heart, Steve.
What frustrates me the most about Episode 3 is there could have been a really stunning bridging film there. There could have been a film that really bridged the gap well between, you know, the prequels and the original trilogy. But there's little things here and there, little decisions that he makes, most specifically where tone is concerned, that totally ruin it for me. The big thing is, of course, turning the Emperor into a Muppet. That was terrible. That was absolutely terrible.
The scene where he becomes one is literally the worst acting
I've ever seen. My little green friend. You know, like,
that's the part I was talking about the most when the movie was over.
Yeah, and the other big thing was they had all this talk about the big showdown between Anakin and Obi-Wan and how epic and how amazing it was. And they shot everything so goddamn close that all you could see was torsos and heads. And it looked like, you know, Ewan McGregor got pulled in by the popo on Sunset Boulevard. All these lightsaber moves, you know, this intricate duel with over 600 lightsaber moves and yada, yada, yada. And you couldn't track any of it because it was shot so damn close. It was ridiculous. Like, I'm watching it unfold on a 2 foot tall or two floor tall movie theater screen, and I can't follow the action because he just shoots it all in close up. And it's just like, why even bother? Why bother, you know, choreographing this intricate fight scene if you're going to shoot it so we can't see it anyway? It was terrible.
I thought a lot of Episode 3 was kind of going through the motions. It's like a checklist. He's got to turn. He's got to, you know, Mace Windu has got to die. We've got to, you know, Anakin and Obi-Wan have to fight. Padme has to die somehow.
Yeah.
We gotta get some Wookiees in here somehow.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna start on that one. Like, why is Chewbacca in this movie? Makes it even smaller.
Wait. Chewbacca knows Yoda?
Yeah.
Why didn't he say anything?
Because nobody understands him.
They all understand him.
And, Padme, dying in childbirth. She dies of heartbreak because she has nothing to live for.
She dies of give up.
But she's got two kids.
Yeah,
two babies.
Like, you're going to leave one of your kids with Jimmy Smits? Come on.
He's a cop. It'll be fine.
And you totally know Sipowicz was babysitting all the time.
Oh.
Wearing only a shirt and
socks. I can't get past the word younglings.
Yeah.
There are sequences in it
that I love. There are sequences in Episode 3 that I love. The whole Article 66 or Article 88 or whatever the heck it was called.
Order 66.
Yeah, that sequence when, like, you know, that creepy music kicks in on the soundtrack and it's just like Jedi being wiped out en masse and ends with, but you know, Anakin attacking
them. That sequence did nothing for me.
I thought it was really well done. I thought it was pretty cool.
It didn't make much sense. Like, you're going to shoot the Jedi?
Like, in terms of the editing and the scoring, it worked. But the visualization of it, and I don't know. Maybe it was just the fact that everything before it was so shitty.
Yeah, and I think that's what it was. I got to that point, and I was like, oh, yeah, shit's getting real now, you know? And it never really does. But that sequence I did like, and was it Episode 3 had the Grievous stuff near the beginning?
Yes.
I thought that shit was pretty cool.
But who
I
is...
Thought, actually, I do have to admit, for a trilogy that had pretty horrible visual character design.
Yeah.
Outside of, you know, the Maul's cool facial tattoos, Grievous felt Star Wars to
me. Yeah, he felt pretty badass.
And I liked the little nod back when Obi-Wan that went the way Obi-Wan takes him out and just the so uncivilized line.
Yeah.
But it's just the rest of it is it's not as bad.
But it was
as
also to me it also seems sort of like a calculated like, hey, remember that thing in Indiana Jones? Oh, you were doing it, but it's Star Wars.
You know it was totally a wink, but who cares?
I care.
The saddest part for me about it, like the saddest part about Episode 3, I mean, I saw Episode 3 again, saw it opening night. It was more because of Sarah than because of me. She's still a Star Wars fan. And I mean, I like I said, I like the prequel, or I like the originals, so you know, whatever. But saw it opening night, the crowd was going absolutely bananas. And when it was over, like, I was kind of, I almost felt a little depressed. And not because of the movie itself, which would depress anybody, but that's it. It's kind of over now. You know, what's left? You know, Lord of the Rings is done. Star Wars is done.
There's more Star Wars. And Star Wars Episode 7 is from the writer of Little Miss Sunshine.
Actually, no, it isn't.
Oh, IMDb lied.
Star Wars Episode 7 is being rewritten by J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan.
Okay, that's good.
Yes. That's very, very good. But, I mean, at that point... And when
I thought we were going to hear him take his headset off, then you're going to hear, like, excited jumping up and down. I'm going to go jump on my bed for a minute.
Yeah, no, the screenplay is...
No, I just did the Lethal Weapon putting the gun away. Held up a picture of Mark Hamill and said, I miss you. Some kids on bikes ride by.
Not right now, Victoria Lynn. But no, you know, it's one of those situations where I kind of walked out and I did feel a little depressed because, you know, that's it. It's all done. You know, like there's not really anything left for all of these like people, whether they loved it or hate it, to feel so passionate about. And I mean, like prime example, you had Avatar after that, which how many people like destroyed that film when it came out. And whereas, you know, in a world pre-Star Wars prequels, I think that movie would have been welcomed with such open arms and loving passion that, you know. I think like the prequel trilogy kind of killed that joy of this whole dorky geeky sign.
Yeah, you missed that episode. And Forbes, were you on that episode?
I was not.
Cameron, and I really missed you guys on that one because the two of you weren't on there. I picked Avatar as my good,
which would have been my choice.
And I was really really drunk as well.
Why was that worthy of mentioning?
I love Avatar. I absolutely adore Avatar, and so many friends and acquaintances of mine rip it apart, and it's like, I'm always like, you people are the biggest hypocrites.
But yeah, I felt that after Episode 3, you know, that was it, that was the end of it all. And I mean, even with Episode 7 coming, people are kind of watching it with a much more guarded eye and all of that kind of thing because of what happened with the prequels, because, you know, they felt that Lucas was raping their childhoods or whatever, which is a foolish notion, you know, like an entirely foolish notion. But
didn't you get the memo? You're not allowed to get excited about things anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, I should have said that like Rucker Hauer.
But I don't, like, you know, I don't hate Episode 3 like I do Episode 2. But at the same time, you know, I still consider it a deeply flawed film. It's something that, you know, I can't
I
really
find it see. Deeply flawed, but I don't hate it as much as Episode 1.
No?
No. I don't know. It doesn't feel quite as plastic to me. Maybe that's it.
I can understand that. And one other thing I'll add about it before I turn it over to you guys. If you haven't done the Star Wars Machete viewing order, if you don't know what it is, Google it.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Is there a version of Star Wars with Danny Trejo?
No. Oh, shut your mouth. Oh, don't even start me on those pieces of crap.
Oh, thank you. I'm not the only one.
Dude, you're totally not the only one.
The whole Grindhouse movement can burn in hell as far as I'm concerned. It's a stupid idea. It's like when Tarantino was releasing these Rolling Thunder Pictures movies in the 90s on VHS. Fuck off. They're garbage.
Hey, I bought Detroit 9000.
It was shit.
I know.
My God.
What was the other one? Jumbo Video Head? Switchblade Sisters.
Yeah.
That was so terrible.
I liked Hobo with a Shotgun. That one was good.
No, I didn't even like that.
I loved it.
No, it wasn't.
But anyway,
I say that as someone who should be supporting the filmmaker from my hometown who made it.
You should. But anyway, Matt, you can regale. You can tell us about the Machete viewing order.
Yeah, it's you watch episode 4, episode 5, and you get the reveal of you know Vader being Luke's son. Then you go back, you skip episode 1, you watch episode 2 and 3 to get the backstory, and then you watch episode 6. And that's actually how I ended up watching it this time because I don't own episode 1, and I thought we were gonna be doing this a little earlier, so I skipped 6, and then that's how it ended up working out. And I watched episode 1 like 3 weeks later, and it really works that way. I mean, it's still got major problems, but it's the best way to watch them, I think.
And the
can I admit something?
And it's always sandwiched in with Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like I can't watch a Star Wars movie for like 10 years. Even the really good ones. I'm Star Wars'd out.
I'm anxiously awaiting.
I got that.
Episode 7. I am. I won't lie.
I am as well, but
I always said
once I've seen, it's too much.
I've kind of like always been saying ever since the prequels first hit, I've always been kind of thinking that Lucas should just let other people play in a sandbox now, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm so immensely happy that that's finally happening, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how excited I got when they announced The Force Unleashed?
Yep.
And how awesome that looked, and like the trailers were badass. That's how I feel about Episode 7.
Yeah, and Force Unleashed was actually pretty damn deadly.
It was.
Yeah. 2, not so much, but the first one was great.
I never played the second one.
Second one was, it was a decent game, it just didn't need to exist. You know, kind of like the prequel trilogy.
Except for the decent part.
So, Lucas... Why you came back to directing, we're not really entirely sure. I don't know why you felt it necessary to guide Star Wars as you did with the prequels. And, I'm kind of glad that we all had this discussion about the prequels because for a little while there, I was actually starting to kind of think that maybe they weren't all that bad. And, you know, like...
Every now and then, Steve...
People who trash the prequels, really shouldn't be trashing the prequels. But now I'm kind of thinking, you know what? No, on second thought. I'm glad I sat down and had this talk with rational people and, you know.
I want you to go down to the basement, put on episode 2.
No.
And watch the asteroid chase and whip yourself with that thing the Catholics whip themselves with.
Flagellate, Steve. Flagellate.
See, that just sounds like a dirty word. I can't flagellate. I'm Catholic. That's what I got married for.
Anyway, next time you feel like, you know, next time you're in one of those moods, give one of us a call.
Yeah. I'll hop on Skype, guys. Save
me. Or I've got a hotline that I can...
I'm starting to think the prequels ain't so bad. Help.
I'm coming over. We're going to watch Avatar.
All right. Any parting thoughts, guys, on episode 3?
Not enough robots with knives.
Yeah, because that one robot with knives was pretty awesome. There was a little more of what I liked in Star Wars, surrounded by a whole crap ton of what I hate in Star Wars.
That makes sense.
Yeah. In the...
And all three definitely feel like they should be cheap paperbacks. Like the worst of the... expanded universe paperbacks written by, I don't know,
all right, so
Ron Hubbard's son.
Wow. Okay, so just to recap, I'll you know put my shout out there first. My good Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, or as I like to call it, just Star Wars. My bad Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, and my ugly Star Wars Episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
I had the exact same choices. I'm with you, Steve.
All right. Solidarity.
I'm going to mix it up a bit. I'm going to say my good is THX, my bad is American Graffiti, and my ugly is Episode 1.
How about you, Mr. Mercer?
My good is Radioland Murders. My bad is Radioland Murders.
This is not – we're not talking Werner Herzog. No cheating.
I think I'm going to give my good to the original Star Wars. I'm going to give my bad to American Graffiti. and I'm going to give my ugly to Attack of the Clones.
Huzzah!
Did we all give our ugly to Attack of the Clones?
No.
I said episode one.
Yeah.
If Forbes had done that, we could have, like, maybe that would have been enough to, like, open up the gate.
Would we have won the jackpot?
No, we could have, like, opened up the gates to the netherworld and cast it in for all eternity.
That could have been, like, three bells, man. We democratically voted it as the ugly. Yeah, we did. We did.
It's the Survivor / Candyman system.
Extinguish your torch, Attack of the Clones.
You've been told to leave the tribal area. The council has spoken.
You will come out no more.
What? Huh? What will come out no more?
Leave Jack Burton alone.
He's a great man. There's all kinds of Big Trouble references this week. Wow. Parting thoughts on George Lucas, the director. Matt, you can go first.
I gotta say, it's strange for a director, and he's considered like one of the great directors. Like people off the street know George Lucas. They don't know a lot of other directors. But like, he's a director who made a couple movies, and then he just spent his entire career mostly in one franchise, which seems kind of strange. But if you hear listening to some of the things he said, like when he was younger, were really interesting. Like something I got into Kurosawa because of him. Something I find really, really like a really cool just movie story in general is that Kurosawa later in his career he started to go really downhill, and he was, you know, I think he attempted suicide at one point. Mm-hmm. And by the time the early 80s came around, a couple of Kurosawa's fans had become major movie directors. Lucas,
Coppola.
I don't know if Scorsese was one of them. And they came back and they helped Kurosawa finance Kagemusha. And then that brought Kurosawa back. Like, I think that's an amazing story right there. That might be one for the Kurosawa episode eventually. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of cool that he came back and he kind of resurrected his own favorite director because of his own success.
I'd be inclined to agree with that one.
My thoughts are that he was a really energetic filmmaker with a really good eye, who had some, unfortunately, sort of built his filmmaking career on nostalgia, which paid off big in one sense, but also. It resonated so strongly with people that he got this empire, and I actually think that he not only would be making better movies if he hadn't had that level of success, he might be happier. Because I kind of get the sense that he's sort of insulated in this world of having so much money, and probably has a lot, and he just doesn't seem to have people who can say no to him, or even really nudge him away from doing some really terrible things. It's almost like he's surrounded by producers who think every idea he has is great, and then all the effects people who are just like, this is so awesome, I'm working on Star Wars. And creative people really need at least some kind of pushback or challenge or limitation in some way, and he lives in a world with no limitations, and it's kind of ruined him. So that's your downer for today.
Always the voice of happiness there, Andrew. You hate fun.
I actually have to agree with Andrew on that. And you always notice it whenever you see interviews with Lucas. He seems sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's because he hates doing interviews, but he always seemed very, very sad. And I do think that it's a... somewhere in there still is that energetic young filmmaker who got trapped by the monster. I think by the time he finished with Return of the Jedi, which, I mean, if you listen to the stories, a lot of it he directed himself.
90% is the word.
Yeah. And with that, all of his, the duties he had taken on as a producer, and I think at the end of that, he was just tired of making movies.
Yeah.
Entirely, so he went and tended the empire, and by the time he was ready to step back behind the camera again, it's just he was an old man, the industry had passed him by.
and he'd become an executive. Or maybe not an executive. Maybe that's not quite the right word. But he he wasn't getting his hands dirty anymore. He was sort of sitting back and planning, you know, new sort of supporting new technologies and, you know, setting up facilities and hanging around with his friends and saying that Indiana Jones scripts weren't good enough and stuff like that.
I find him, like, I think he's a pretty amazing guy in that, you know, you read interviews with him and, you actually see interviews with the guy and even when you watch some of the documentaries, like you watch The Beginning or Empire of Dreams or all these, he's brutally honest. The man is, you know, he's aware of the criticisms. He's aware of everything that's gets levied against him. He's aware of all these raped your childhood accusations and whatnot. And he's not even like James Cameron is. You know, like I love the classic, you know, the classic James Cameron when presented with quotes from Dave Johnson's DVD verdict review of Avatar. He says, you know, I can't help that guy. You know, and like Cameron is an asshole.
You just got Cameroned.
Yeah, you know, like Cameron is not an asshole about it. You know, Cameron's kind of like, yeah, fuck you. You didn't like the movie. It's your own problem. Whereas Lucas is aware of it, and Lucas is like, he's generally concerned about it, not to the point, you know, that he's going to compromise his own vision, but he's definitely going to make considerations because of it. And, you know, when Crystal Skull came out, when Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was released, there was an amazing interview with him. I think it might have been Time Magazine. And, like, he talked about, you know, fans are going to hate this movie. Fans are going to see this movie, and they're going to hate it. But, you know, it's just because of how they feel about the existing movies. And on top of that, you know, like, we're going out and we're making the movie that we wanted to make. We're, like, myself and Spielberg agreed on everything. And, you know, we did the movie that we wanted to do. And, you know, yeah, there's some stuff I don't agree on in it. And there's some stuff Spielberg doesn't like. But the end result is the compromise between the two of them. And Lucas always acknowledges that. Like, Lucas acknowledges that, you know, he's not perfect. He is only human, and he only does, you know, he does what he wants to do. He follows his own vision, and there's times he'll compromise, and there's times he'll back off, but at the end of the day, it's his movie, you know, and when you got
if you have a problem with that, he'll spit venom into your face.
No, it's not even like that. Like, he's genuinely, like, what amazes me about the guy is he is genuinely humbled by that. Like, he when people respond so negatively to it, that's why he backs off. This is why he sold off Lucasfilm to Disney. He just said, you know, I can't be a part of this anymore because it causes me too much stress. It just causes me too much anxiety. And, you know, like, I gotta say, I respect the guy for that, you know?
But if he allowed some of that in the door with the people who are working for him when he's making the movies, I think...
But then, I think he does. Like, I sincerely think that he does. I don't think he is really the yes man that people make, or like, the dictator that people make him out to be. Like, I know...
I don't think he's a dictator. He doesn't realize how little resistance he's actually getting.
Yeah, and I think that's more what it is. I think it's an honest assumption on his part, you know? Like, if people had a problem with this, they'd tell me and I'd fix it.
Exactly.
You know? I sincerely don't think the fault lies entirely, entirely with him.
No, I agree.
You know, and I'm amazed that the guy can be so, I guess, detached is the
word. I'll say this: he's actually better than Hitler.
I think he's an interesting cat, and I actually I really look forward to him going back and just making movies again outside of the Star Wars hype. You know, like I look forward to seeing more stuff from him that, like, well...
I would love if we didn't hear anything about it, and then he just turned up 10 years from now with 3 movies.
Yeah.
That no one had any idea he'd been working on.
Yeah.
That he'd gone to South America or something.
Yeah, like, no, something like that.
You guys heard the story about what he did when he was trying to buy that huge bit of property to, you know, build a film studio on it, right? And the all the shit that was going on with the neighboring community and that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they wanted – I don't know what they wanted to turn into, a golf club or whatever. And when he went to – when he finally sold the property off or whatever, he sold it to turn it into low-rent housing.
Yep.
Or whatever. They need to make a Caddyshack-style screwball comedy about that story.
And it's just – you know, like, I love that.
When I read that, I stopped picturing George Lucas as I've seen him in all the interviews with his, you know, big gray beard and everything. And I started picturing Rodney Dangerfield.
I love too, like, you know, like he sells out to Disney and everybody starts shouting at him and calling him a sellout, and then he turns around and says, like, the $6 billion or whatever that Disney paid for it, all of it is going to charity. Like, it's not even going to into his bank account. It's going to education and all of this kind of stuff. And then even then, like, even then the guy can't win. You know, he comes out and he says, like, every bit of profit I made off of that sale, I'm not keeping. And then they turn around and say it's all
Steve,
a
Steve, he made episode 2.
Yeah,
come on.
They turn around and they say it's a tax scam and he's only doing it so he doesn't have to pay taxes on it. And it's like, boys, come on. Like, seriously, there's a point where hatred just becomes ridiculous, you know?
But it still hurts Bilbo.
I think as far as, like, technical skill goes, I think the guy's a pretty ingenious technical director. I think he's an amazing editor. And I really look forward to, you know, because I'm hoping that when Lucas goes back to make his little personal movies that he claims no one is going to want to see, I'm hoping we see a lot more THXs and a lot more American Graffitis, man. Not literally, but, you know, metaphorically speaking.
Figuratively?
Yeah. Ecumenically?
Sensually.
Ecclesiastically?
I got to say, I dug Red Tails as saccharine and syrupy as it was. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it.
And I love that word, saccharine.
Yeah, it's a great word. But I mean, if
that's what, so much of what you love.
If that's what we have to look forward to, you know, like pulpy, old school kind of filmmaking, then you know what? Bring it on. I'm cool with that. I guess that's it on Lucas. I guess that shuts the book, shuts the door, unless anybody else wants to chime in.
No. The chimes are silent.
That's it for this week. Be sure to come back next time. I won't say next week. I'll say next time. See what I did there?
I do see what you did.
When we
and
tackle...
you're still going to break that promise somehow.
Who are we tackling?
It's another big one. It is possibly the biggest big one. It is Alfred Hitchcock.
I thought you were going to say Steven Spielberg when you said the biggest big one.
Oh, come on.
Steven Spielberg is the Wayne Gretzky of filmmaking, goddammit.
And Alfred Hitchcock is the...
Bobby Orr.
NHL.
Hitchcock was actually one of the guys when we first started doing this. We were all like, we can't do Hitchcock first, or we can't do Spielberg first, or we can't do Kurosawa first, because that automatically, you know, that just outs us right away.
Yeah.
Let's do Walter Hill.
So we did Walter Hill. And then he betrayed us with Bullet in the Head.
I haven't seen it yet, so I can't really comment. Yeah, well, I saw it the other day. Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet either, and I've heard description. How do you fuck up an axe fight? That just sounds so amazing.
The axe fight was actually decent.
Yeah, but it only lasts for like 3 seconds, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. and it's basically the only good part of it.
So anyway, Alfred Hitchcock, next time. They came from the north.
Nice.
I guess all that's left to say is what?
See you next Wednesday.
Screw off, Gabe.